Welcome to the Industry Talks podcast. I'm your host, Roman Perry. So, Industry Talks news. We have a big change coming to our panel. I can't really talk about it on this episode yet, but if you want to keep up with just kind of what we have in store for the next panel coming up in August, follow us on our Twitter at @INDTalks and then check us out online at industrytalks.net. On this episode, we've got Ian Galdi, the manager, creative, and self-described serial musical entrepreneur. He's worked with acts like Crywolf, Herobust, Gabriel Black, and Imad Royal. We talk about his come up in the industry, and he relays a lot of really valuable lessons and wisdom. And to be honest, this guy is wise beyond his years. So I hope you guys enjoy it. Here it goes.
Industry Talks.
Ian, why don't you, well, first of all, welcome to the Industry Talks podcast. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
It's exciting to have you on. Do you want to take a moment and introduce yourself and tell us what you're all about?
Sure. My name is Ian Galdi. I am a self-described musical serial entrepreneur, which is just a fancy way of saying that I've done entirely way too many things, all involving the music industry. Worked with a bunch of artists, labels, and brands. I've started my own label. I've managed some great artists like Crywolf, Herobust, Gabriel Black, Savoy. I've done consulting for brands like Netflix, I Am Other, worked with some really cool labels like Astroworks, Monster Cat, Dimmock Records, Mad Decent, Ausla. Most of my work has been in the EDM space, kind of recently been branching out more into the Indian rock space. Started my own label a while ago, found some amazing artists like Imad Royal and Kai, lived in Nashville, lived here, lived in North Carolina. I don't know, whole bunch of stuff. I do a whole bunch of stuff, social media, master side, everything except publishing. Is really what everything except for publishing, which I still don't understand. I don't think anyone understands publishing. I don't even think publishers understand publishing.
I think they want you to think that I think that's their goal is nobody understands
My favorite thing recently, even though I was told recently that this is actually not publishing, which would be a reason that they don't understand it, is neighboring rights.
What are neighboring rights?
I still don't know what neighboring rights are. Someone explained it to me. But effectively what it is, as far as I understand it, and I'm going to fuck it up, is that neighboring rights are royalties collected from non-US-based terrestrial radio.
Okay.
I think.
So like Canada radio?
Canadian radio? God, I don't like that we're talking about publishing because I don't know anything about publishing. But I'll do my best. Someone explained this to me recently and I'm going to fuck it up. I want to give that disclaimer.
Disclaimer given.
I'm going to fuck it up.
Yeah.
Effectively what it is that in the US, you make, if you're a publisher or you own publishing, you make most of your money from radio. That's why publishers really care about hits on the radio, and radio is still a big thing because the royalties are so strong. As master owners, you don't make anything from the radio. It's only the writers. Now, industry's gotten really weird, and a lot of non-writers have secured publishing just because of that. But effectively, that's just because of the U.S. law. And the way it's set up. But that's not everywhere. In Europe and all those countries, there's a different set of rules. In Australia, there's a different set of rules. Asian markets, completely different set of rules. So neighboring rights, I think, when it comes down to it, have to do with collecting royalties based on those different set of rules that have to do with radio. I as far as I it might encompass other things beyond radio, but I think that's why it's technically not considered publishing, is because it's like in other countries, master owners get royalties from the radio.
But which is, I think that's kind of how it should be.
I think it's that
to an extent.
Yeah, that's probably how it should be. Although it's, yeah, it definitely is how it should be, because it's really weird. Like in the US, master owners, i.e. record labels, pay a ton of money to get on the radio.
Right.
But they don't make any money back from it. Unless, of course, they've secured, they have a publishing company. But even that, that's technically a separate company.
Right.
They're still shuffling money around at that point.
Or maybe it's because, like, if you have an artist that has a radio hit, you're going to make more money in other spaces.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely it, right?
Right.
And that's kind of, like, trickled off into why, you know, say YouTube channels have said, oh, well, we're not going to share any revenue.
Right.
It's because, like, you're getting a ton of promotion out of this. I don't agree with it as much because I think that I came up on, like, the marketing side of things.
Right.
And the master side of things. So it's, like, aggravating to me. And don't get me wrong, I love YouTube. I'm a huge YouTube proponent.
Yeah.
Like I think it's the future. I don't really think it's a coincidence that I don't know if it's the biggest, but it's probably pretty close.
One of the biggest. You can only say one of.
We'll say one of the biggest. But one of the biggest privately owned Spotify playlists is The Nations, which is like just their nuts. They're amazing. Like what they've built is insane. I don't know how big it is at this point. It's huge. It's millions and millions and millions of subscribers on there. But it's not, I don't think it's a coincidence that it's stemmed from a YouTube space.
Right.
The interaction on YouTube is just through the roof.
As far as like being able to comment on songs and things like that, or
just the amount that fans will interact. And that I think is an algorithm thing and a culture thing. You'll constantly hear anyone say that, at least that knows this, that the biggest music streaming platform is YouTube.
Yeah.
By far.
100%.
I think it doesn't make its way into the conversation because the royalties are not that good.
No.
So, you know, everyone's focused on Spotify. Recently, there was this whole thing about Tidal because Tidal's royalties are super high, but who's on Tidal?
Right.
I would hope that people would go on Tidal. I think that would actually be beneficial. I think the more spread out things are and the more decentralized that audience are, the better it is for content creators.
Yeah.
Right now, it seems to be a huge amount of people on Spotify. There's a huge uptick in people on going to Apple. Amazon's going to make a huge play in the next year and a half, just because, like, Bezos is on a war path to own the world.
Yeah.
So whether or not he actually gives a shit about content creators, he probably doesn't. But like, I think he just wants to own everything. Right. And in order to own everything, he realizes that he needs to own this space. So at least in the, I don't know in the long term, if someone being on a war path to own the world is it's definitely a bad thing. But in the short term, their investment into owning will help content creators.
Right.
And of course, there'll be pushback.
But this is something that I've always, because like, what do you think about Patreon?
Patreon as a specific entity, I think is very interesting. I love the idea, and there's a lot of spaces that are similar, right? I think Patreon is kind of like bred out of like the Kickstarter culture.
Definitely.
Similar situation. There's another one that I used for a campaign that I cannot remember the name of.
Indiegogo.
So it was one very specific to music. We overstepped our bounds in using it. It was really cool, but it was also that Pledge Music.
Okay, I've heard of Pledge Music.
Pledge Music. So Pledge is just Patreon, but very specific to like pre-orders.
Right.
And their whole bit is that they've got a great system that reports directly to Nielsen.
Right.
So your pre-orders will then count towards your Billboard.
Like album sales.
Yeah. Presuming someone actually clicks download.
Right.
Which is a whole other thing and a whole other problem.
Right.
And I think a lot of the reason that, you know, they made that play towards streaming counting so heavily towards it, because people are just, even if they have the download, even if they bought the download, are just not downloading it. If you make content, then you might need the file.
Yeah.
If you're managing content, you might need the file.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you're performing content, you might need the file. But other than that, you really don't need it.
No.
I mean, at this point, like, I use Apple Music and Spotify and YouTube to discover.
Right.
It's, and then if I fall in love with something, I'll go and buy physically the vinyl.
Right. Because then you actually own
an item. Because then I own an item.
Yeah.
Yeah. It benefits the artists and the labels far greater than the stream does. It's a piece of merch. I have too many t-shirts as is. And I also have, like, I got hip to the whole, like, a bunch of really successful people have done this, but like the whole uniform kick,
right?
Of just like, find the outfit that you really dig.
Yeah.
And then just buy a bunch of those.
Yeah.
And because, like, A, it'll help people remember you.
Yeah.
And B, then you don't have to, that's one less thing you have to think about.
Right.
And it doesn't mean you should be boring. It's just kind of like, it's just helpful.
Yeah. No, I'm a big proponent of the uniform.
I love the uniform.
I was wearing a black t-shirt, jeans, and a denim jacket for probably 5 years straight.
This one t-shirt that I'm wearing, I think I own like 15 of them.
Yeah.
Not going to say where it's from because fuck them. But anyway, point is, find your uniform.
What got you into music?
I love music.
But like, where did you start off as a musician? Did you start off, because you grew up in
I think North Carolina. Most people do. I think most people who end up working in the music industry like have some musical background.
Yeah.
And if you don't, I don't want to say that you're whack because you're not, like, but it's kind of weird.
Right.
I think most kids, no one when they're a kid is like, I want to be an agent. Like,
right.
No 8 year old like wants to be an agent or a manager or like a publisher. Like,
yeah.
You know, everyone wants to be a rock star. Like, and then at a certain point I think part of maturing is that you start realizing either you're just not that skilled at something, or you have other skill sets, or even the skill sets that you have aren't necessarily good for you.
Right.
Just because you're good at something doesn't mean that thing is good for you.
Right.
So, you know, and I also think there's kind of like an air of, when you're growing up, encouragement for the environment around you. I think there's a lot of wildly talented people who maybe didn't pursue an area because the environment around them wasn't supportive enough.
Right.
When you're first starting out in any given skill set, but especially in art, you're not going to be good. You're going to suck.
Right.
And the only way to not suck is just to do it a lot. And of course, there's rare cases. There's virtuosos, right? There's two-year-olds who can play Bach, which you can find on YouTube, and it's delightful and amazing. But for the vast majority of us who aren't born with that, you practice a lot. Like, I mean, at least my parents, bless them, who are wildly supportive of all of my ridiculous ideas. You know, the constant thing is like, okay, well, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. Mm-hmm. But when someone's practicing, the worst thing you can do is critique their practice.
Right.
You know, critiquing art is one thing. And I think it's important and it's a skill that needs to be developed. And it's a very amazing balancing act that make for wonderful managers.
Right.
Some of the best, especially, I think you need that skill in any sort of like rights management space, whether you're an agent or an A&R or a manager, even a lawyer. Like, if you work with artists at all, having the skill of being able to delicately balance where you critique and where you support can make or break an artist.
Right.
I mean, completely.
Yeah.
and break in both the positive and negative sense of the term.
Yeah.
I can definitely remember back on some scenarios where, you know, I mean, I was like making songs and like I made songs in college. I recorded them. But I went to UNC Asheville. I originally was going there to be in the music program because Bob Moog, one of the people, because this is a very highly debated topic in that community, but one of the people who is credited inventing the synthesizer. That's like, I really hope some synth nerd gives me shit about that. Really hope.
But that's still, he was a pioneer in the world.
That's the most political correct way to say that.
Okay.
I like that. That's the thing I choose to be politically correct about.
Is like synth music.
Fuck Trump, but let me be very careful about Bob Moog.
Yeah.
And so when I toured the school in 2005,
right?
I met him.
Really?
Yeah. Lovely guy. Amazing. And then he died. Like I applied to the school, I got in, and he died. I was just like, well, I'm going to go to the school anyway, because like it's cool, liberal arts college, it's small, it's got all the things I want. I've got some friends going, you know, it'll be fine. And they replaced him to run the music department with some jazz dickhead. I don't even remember his name, but if you're by even remote chance, if you were the head of the music department at UNC Asheville in 2006 to whenever you were, then fuck you, you're an asshole, and you discouraged a lot of talented people from pursuing their dreams.
Yeah,
that's my harsh word for this podcast is that dude. I don't remember his name, but he sucked. And yeah, just super, super discouraging. And, you know, I ended up quitting the music department and like freaking out, wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. Some very important and supportive people kind of came along and said, listen, you're 18. You don't need to know what you want to do, even though you're very convinced you're an adult. You're not.
Right.
So it's fine. Just do things.
Yeah.
It'll be okay. And just do things, I think, is one of the best pieces of advice I've ever gotten in my entire life.
Yeah.
Because it's very important. But, you know, I ended up going into graphic design and motion graphics. Mm-hmm. Loved it. Did a double major in mass communications and that. Originally, I went into mass communications because I was like, oh, I can do video editing in mass communications. But they, you know, their whole bit was like, oh, well, the highest you're ever going to achieve is working for a local news outlet. And I'm just like, fuck that. No. Like,
yeah,
that might be your dream. It's not mine. But I had so many credits in that space anyway, it just kind of made sense to finish. And then I did multimedia arts and sciences, which is a delightfully supportive program. So if you were a professor in the multimedia arts and sciences department at UNC Asheville, then bravo, because you're amazing. And you supported a lot of really talented people. And you were the opposite of the dickhead who ran the music department. I learned a lot about branding, learned a lot about marketing, a lot about art, a lot about the way that art interacts with culture. And just got super into it. And kind of on the side, I was making music. I was recording music. I still have a lot of friends in the music department. So you could rent out these amazing studios.
Yeah.
Because Bob Moog at one point had headed it, you pretty much any Moog piece of equipment you wanted was at your disposal.
That's sick.
Which was amazing. And yeah. I definitely didn't take full advantage of it. I wish I had. But, you know, recorded some cool stuff with some friends in their studios, in my house. You know, taught myself how to multi-track, just trial and error of getting stoned and setting up microphones and, you know, plugging microphones into guitar pedals, shocking the shit out of your mouth because you plugged a microphone into a guitar pedal.
Yeah. Getting zapped.
Yeah. You know, like, and just like learning and experimenting and figuring shit out. And then I got around that time, when I was first learning to do graphic design,
right.
It was all still stuff at that point. I hadn't really moved into video effects. So I would go to YouTube for like an endless playlist of music. And as it turns out, the best stuff to listen to when you're just kind of dicking around on Photoshop and learning things
right.
is EDM.
Yeah.
And I discovered Rusko. I discovered Benga. I discovered Koki. Like all of the UK dubstep that was just incredible. Shouts out. What was that channel?
UKF.
Thank you. God. Shouts out UKF. Oh, geez. Amazing. You guys really, really did an amazing thing for bringing, for bringing EDM to the forefront. So pioneers, shouts out UK.
What year was this just about? Like,
I'd say like 2007.
Okay.
And then you just, YouTube's amazing because you have all these related videos. So you listen to one and here's 12 things that might be similar. So you just, endless musical discovery, just endless. And Pandora too. I was big into Pandora at the time as well. But Pandora was annoying because you just get like the ads and I just, as a college student, so I refused to pay for anything. And YouTube, you could still download a patch for like, you know, for like Firefox or I don't think Chrome was a thing at that point.
Yeah. But you get the plug, like,
you get the plug into like Adblock or whatever, like, and just endless music, you know, discovery. And also at that point, you know, a lot of this music, I don't necessarily know had US distribution. I don't know what had like a rights management situation on YouTube.
Yeah.
It's still very early in that space.
Remember that. I'll remember that like blue shield symbol for the rest of my life.
It's, you know, and like figuring out how to make it like bounce. Like, oh, so good. You know, like all of just, they really started so much. And just did it. That was truly for the love. Cause like they weren't taking anything from that.
Yeah.
It's just pure curation. You know, eventually moved on to figuring out, you know, things about how it connected to artists that I knew, you know, and figuring out that there's this interwoven thread of artists and it's really not, they're not all that far removed from each other. You know, figuring out that you hear A-Track and Fool's Gold. And then you find out like, oh, A-Track is Dave One's brother. Dave One's in Chromeo. I love Chromeo. Oh my God. I just saw him at Bonnaroo. Like you start seeing all this like connectivity and you realize, okay, there's something happening here.
Right.
You know, I don't know. Just, I guess at like a certain point, I just decided I just wanted to be a part of it. So there was a local promotion company, in Asheville, and my friend, Lindsay Wilkerson, shouts out Lindsay Wilkerson. She was dating a friend of mine at the time who was this guitarist that I was like jamming with. And I met her and she was working for this company called MCP Presents. And she was like, we need an intern. Would you want to do something? And I was like, absolutely. Yeah, let's do it. And they were responsible for booking a lot of the local EDM shows. They brought Benga, they brought Scream, they brought Rusko, they brought Excision. I remember seeing Excision in a 400 cap room, no production whatsoever. Just the production was sweat. The production was sweat in Mali. That was the production, which was sick.
I remember that era too. It was just the
so
best.
Good.
Yeah.
And she was like, yeah, just come be an intern here. And I was like, okay, great. So I did, and I met this guy, Jonathan Forden. And Lindsay and John were the first people to really, I think, you know, just see kind of a passion in me and give me some semblance of a shot.
Yeah.
You know, I made posters, I promoted the shows, I promoted my own shows. I'd kind of like, without really asking them, but, you know, having somewhat of a silent understanding, throw, you know, non-approved after parties.
Right.
You know, at the smaller venue down the street. And, you know, I would play it. You know, I figured out how to DJ on Ableton.
Yeah.
My friends of mine did. I met other people who, you know, were going through the same musical discovery and getting into, you know, electronic music and wanting to figure this space out.
Yeah.
You know, and just kind of like threw shows with those people and like hung out with those people and those people became my friends. And yeah, you know, like really early on, like, you know, you just trial and error, figure out things about marketing. You know, you throw in a show. Okay, how do you get people to the show? Well, you know, there needs, who do we, Who do we tell? Okay, well, let's throw an after party because, you know, that's an existing audience. So there's all these things that you're doing that you don't even realize that you're doing. You're going after an existing demographic that's already curated for you.
Yeah.
You know, figuring out how to invite everybody to a Facebook, you know, event, you know, going in and finding like the codes that would automatically.
Yeah. Those JavaScript like, copy and JavaScript paste codes.
Copy and paste stuff. Like, you know, before there was plugins that like did this shit for you.
Yeah.
I want to get away from that before I start sounding like the EDM equivalent of like Joe Budden.
Yeah.
Just like, you kids don't even know.
Yeah. No, it was the
that's
time.
That's my Joe Budden
It was a good time. Like that. Because like, I feel like there was a time when like, you know, before, you know, the major booking agency, like before, like, you know, your Live Nation got a hold of these artists to start booking them at these larger venues.
Yeah. You know, like there was, well, it was also just like, I don't think there was enough of a proven concept in that space yet for them to like, for them to hop on.
Yeah.
And I think to a large extent there still isn't.
Yeah.
You know, those major spaces still, they've bought out a lot of these companies, but like, you know, anytime one of those spaces buys out a space, there's a lot of brouhaha about it. But 9 times out of 10, you know, unless it's the whole situation that happened with like Gary and Hard, they keep the people involved. They just say, like, we're going to buy you, but you just keep running you.
Yeah.
You know, like, you see that with, like, Pasquale, like, who I admire greatly. And I think, like, he's curated and created such an amazing space and experience for people. But, yeah, so, anyway, that's just kind of how I got some footing. And, you know, I started focusing my efforts on DJing more because with all of the stuff that I was learning about graphic design and motion graphics and branding and marketing from class and also just real-time experience through like helping out with these shows. But the people who were really influencing me, I mean, Skrillex I loved, but the people who were really influencing me were the people whose shows that I saw were just like something completely different. I loved Dan Deacon.
Deacon was amazing.
I loved Girl Talk. Dan Deacon's still amazing, still doing incredible stuff. They were doing something different. A lot of the EDM guys were kind of like falling into this space of like, I have a table, I'm at the table.
Right.
At a certain point, people will come on stage.
And nobody had people on stage better than Girl Talk did.
No, exactly. Yeah. Girl Talk was like, fuck all that. Like, I don't give a shit. I'm not hiring dancers. Everyone just come on stage.
Doesn't matter.
Fuck you, whatever.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
And like, you're just there to have a good time and party.
Yeah.
And you're going to sing along and you're going to have a great time. That's the only purpose of this.
Yeah.
You're coming to be a part of a thing.
It's a communal experience as opposed to just like, we're going to observe this.
Exactly. I was really influenced by those people who are kind of like curating these kind of party atmospheres and like senses of community. And I just loved that. I was just trying to figure out how do I even like go about that. And I, you know, wanted to play more, and I got so good at the branding thing that I, you know, ended up playing festivals. I played regionally, and I was trying, I was like, oh shit, I'm, you know, I want to play more. I want to go other spaces. So I was like, I need a manager. I think I need an agent. Like, I didn't really know what those things were at that point. I just kind of knew that peripherally other people that were more successful than me had these things. And I was like, oh, I got to get this. So I was kind of searching and, you know, I'd have these conversations. They go, cool, like send me your music. And I'd be like, about that. And I just like, wasn't really making it.
Right.
And I also wasn't really convinced that I could. I kind of just kept going and was just like, I'll just keep DJing and riding this train as far as it'll go. And after I graduated, I moved back to Durham, North Carolina.
What year did you graduate?
2010.
Okay.
And then I had this like, I made all these like Girl Talky type mixtapes that were on SoundCloud. They might be still there. And if they are, it's a miracle that they didn't get like some sort of
and,
copyright
get
thing.
Get pulled down.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they probably wouldn't because like all the songs are from like 2007, 2008.
Right.
It would be like basically the gist of it was like I would pull all these songs that I loved and then I would go on big shouts out right here, acapellasforyou.uk.
Oh, dude. Yes. Yeah.
Big shout out.
Yeah.
And I'd grab everything, just everything I could find. Didn't matter what it was. Didn't care. I just knew that I needed some sort of popular. If I recognized it, I downloaded it. And I just like switched things out. I just switched things out over stuff until like something kind of felt like it worked. And then I kind of go in with like the Ableton 6 quantizing tool.
The warp tool.
And just, yeah, and just warp it until it kind of felt right. And then I'd, you know, do that until I had made like an hour's worth of content.
Right.
And upload it. And then on one of them, this band at the time called Cry Wolf commented on it and was like, yo, this is cool. Like we're based in Raleigh too, which is very close to Durham.
Yeah.
There's a triangle, Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill.
Yeah.
You know, like, let's connect. Like, okay, cool. As it turns out, the drummer was a little brother of my friend Christian, who I grew up knowing. He also didn't mention that. So when I met him, I was like, hey, you look familiar. Because him and his brother look just alike.
Yeah.
And I was like, you look familiar. Why do I know you? Like, you know, he just like didn't say anything. And then finally, like, they invited me to a show and his brother was there. And I was like, and I went to introduce myself to, like, I hadn't seen his brother in like a while. Because like, he had gone to college, I think in Colorado. And like, we had like both gained some weight. And like you do in college.
Yeah, of course.
And so I saw him and I was like, I went to reach out my hand to introduce myself. And I was like, no, that feels wrong. Wait, what? No, fuck. Oh my God. Amazing. And, I saw their show and it was this guy, John Luke and, Justin Phillips. And the show was bad. They were very sloppy. the audio is not good. But there was just like this really indescribable spark because it was different. It's different from like all the things that I had seen. Like, you know, there was singing and, you know, there was dubstep and there was a drummer and there was like all this stuff. And I was like, this is different. This is cool. And it's like, I had seen like drummers in EDM before. There's like Kyoto, there's Numa Trio, there was like, but it was all kind of like under the guise of like, we loved Fish. Like,
right.
You know, and we also like EDM. So we'd right. like to pair the two. And I'd never seen anyone do it with like, I love dubstep. And I'd certainly never seen anyone do it with like, I loved emo music and dubstep. And I remembered thinking in college, hearing My Name is Skrillex EP for the first time and thinking, oh my God, this is going to be huge. This is going to be huge. Like but I had no ability to even begin the thought process of how do I be involved?
Right.
So I knew like, okay, this is a similar, not the same feeling, but this is a similar feeling.
Right.
So, and now I have an opportunity
yeah.
to try and get involved.
This has potential.
Yeah. So, you know, I talked to them and like, I kind of already know they like look up to me in some semblance because they reached out, you know, like, and so I talked to them after the show and I was like, hey, I'd really like to work with you guys. And they were like, oh, how? Like, I don't know, like, manager. They were like, have you done management? No. Like, you know, but, you know, I'll work really, really, really hard.
Yeah.
You know, and I did this for myself. I can do it for you. You know, and this is really the space that I want to go into. Like, I feel like if I bring these skills, you know, if I bring the marketing skills and the design skills, the branding skills, and you guys bring the musical skills, you know, we could really make something happen. And we just hacked it. Like, we just... You know, like day one, like, what do we do? You know, like, we've got music. Okay, how do we get people to listen to the music? Like, all right, we gotta make some art for their socials. Where do people listen to music? You know, just kind of like, it was like, I listen to music on YouTube. Like, UKF, how do I get in touch with UKF? You know, like, there's gotta be other spaces like UKF. Like, what are these other spaces? Okay, there's blogs. There's Hype Machine. Holy shit, there's a space called Hype Machine. What are all the blogs on Hype Machine? How do I get in touch with the blogs? You know, just like, you start asking questions and answering those questions for yourself.
Right.
And then, you know, that's like step one, is just ask a million questions. And step two is kind of like answer those questions poorly. And then like step three is the continuous process
right.
of all time, which is just consistently refine the answer to that question.
Yeah.
And the questions have never really changed, you know, like how do we get larger audiences to hear or view or interact? That's yeah. never altered.
How do we get fans?
How do we get fans? How do we get the people who might be responsible for introducing us to those audiences, how do we get them to say yes?
Yeah.
The bloggers, the YouTube channel owners, the label A&Rs, the agents, the, you know, other managers of other artists, the gatekeepers. How yeah. do we, you know, so those questions have never changed. It's just the initial answer has been, just been refined over time. And we just, you know, just trial and error. And, you know, eventually through that got, with like the first official song release we did, we went number one on Hype Machine, which was like crazy.
Nuts.
And at the time I was like, I am a genius. I know everything there is to know about the music industry.
No one can touch me.
This is perfect. Yeah. We're great. And, and you know, some people had reached out after that. And, there was this guy, Dex Palmer, who I had known because he had thrown this festival called Dex Fest. He brought these crazy artists out. It initially started as like a festival for his birthday and then kind of turned into like a real thing once it turned out that people would show up. But he brought Soundtribe and Big Gigantic and Skrillex and like M Machine when they were known as Metropolis. Shouts out M Machine. Kind of met him through I had semi-snuck into his festival. I had like gotten credentials through MCP.
Yeah.
Because I was kind of still working with him at the time. With one of the festivals. This was before the whole Crywolf thing. And, you know, I had just like traded up like my credential, like some like VIP credential I had gotten to an all access.
Right.
And I was like back there and I like saw him and I was like, you're Dex. You're the Dex guy. And he was like, what are you doing back here? And I was like, this is a fucking birthday party. Like
yeah.
he knows everyone who has
the
I was like
VIP.
I was like, no, it's cool, man. Like I work with like John. He was like, you work John crazy.
Yeah.
You know, like we like became friends. And then he had like stopped working, he had stopped doing the festival because the county sheriff was like super against it. And there was like this whole legal battle like between them and about it. And so he was like, hey, like, you know, I kind of seen some of the stuff that you're doing. Like, I really want to get into management. I have all these connections in the agency world because I've been booking these artists. I've been talent buying, you know, so I know all these people and I've developed all these relationships. Let's work together. And like really without much research at all, I was like, yeah, let's do it. This is gonna be great.
Yeah.
And so we just kind of started and we like, formed this company. That's how Octal Sound started. And, you know, he was like, I've got a tip about this guy, Hero Bust from Atlanta. You know, he's making all this like really weird glitchy music. And he's got some like interesting credentials and like he's opened for Flying Lotus before. He's been on a few labels. But you know, I had a conversation with him. He said he wants to make dubstep. And I had prior to that had this idea that I had wanted to run with for a while, which was finding someone in that glitch scene, which was super popular, especially in the Southeast then.
Yeah.
If I could find someone from that scene who I still somewhat make for the best sound designers. If I could convince one of those people to make dubstep, well, they would just murder. They would take over the game.
Yeah.
Because like they actually understand sound design. It's not just like they would make something different. The reason I love Skrillex is because he completely changed the scope of what sound design could
right.
be. So if I could find someone who could unlock another level of that
yeah.
and just convince them to be in this lane of music that had a higher ceiling than the yeah. glitch scene, it would work. Here's somebody who has already kind of decided that that's what they want to do.
Yeah.
You know, and it took a long time to get him to like really Hayden to get him to like break away from that style. Like so much of the early Hero Bust stuff that like I had worked on was just like still very glitchy. You know, it still maintained that style. It really wasn't fully committed. Just learned a lot about, you know, how to translate audiences and how to, you know, get sometimes learn to let go of prior fans and how to rebrand and how to, you know, move into different spaces. And I still maintain that Hayden is one of the best sound designers in the world, potentially.
Yeah. I mean, his stuff is so crisp.
Yeah, it's absurd.
Yeah.
You know, Dex and I and Hero Bust and Crywolf, I ended up moving out to Nashville because Hunter Williams from CAA wanted to sign Hero Bust. And the reason he wanted to sign Hero Bust was because we, at the time, the game was like, okay, like how do we make a huge impact on socials? You know, we need bigger socials because that's going to get us an agent. And because all the people we're seeing getting booked, they have bigger socials than us. So how do we do that? Alex Botwin, I don't know if Alex was the first. Shouts out, Alex. Alex was launching Paper Diamond at the time and did this thing that we all came to know as like for download.
Yeah.
And that really just started that whole space. I don't know if Alex was the first one to do it, but it was the first one I saw do it.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh shit, I'm going to fucking steal this. But Alex did it for one or like two songs and really spaced them out. And like, to his credit, was way more strategic than we were. But I was just like, I'm just going to throw everything we have at this. We're going to put out a song a week. We're going to put out a remix a week. I think we put out a remix a week for like 10 weeks.
Jesus.
Nuts. Like, we just like anything he could remix, any popular hip hop song he could remix. We were just like, remix that, just throw it up. SoundCloud, like for download, go. Like, this was before Tone Dead. There was like a script you were running on Facebook.
Yeah.
So like, you didn't even have a button on SoundCloud. You'd be like, you'd write in the SoundCloud name, download in description.
Right.
You know, like, and it would link to Facebook where you could then like to download it. And we put out a bunch of remixes that like kind of worked. And then we put out a Knife Party remix. And the Knife Party remix went bananas.
Which Knife Party song was it?
It was...
Internet Friends?
Internet Friends.
Okay.
That's correct. We, I think in a week, went from having 10,000 followers to 25,000 followers.
That's great.
And there was kind of the stars align moment where Next Big Sound had launched. And Next Big Sound eventually, I think, got picked up by Billboard, who I think still owns them now. But they had launched, there was an app to very easily track, you know, social and sales rankings and compare them to each other. So you could kind of like compare where artists were with
like
their
clout or something different like that.
Endeavors.
Social Blade.
Yeah. It was like an early Social Blade, I feel like. But very specifically for musicians.
Right.
And it ranked socials and social growth. And after that, we were the number one artist.
Right.
Then so I woke up one day, like kind of refreshed it just to see, because like I remember like from the earlier remixes, we were kind of floating in that top 50 space, and we went from like number like 49 or like 39 or whatever to number one. Like,
it's great.
And so I was like, Dex and I got together, sent that to, and we had already been kind of talking to Hunter a little bit because like we all lived in Nashville. We had this artist. It was kind of like, it made a lot of sense to, for him to be on like Pretty Lights kind of music space.
Yeah.
So we were trying to convince him of that. Never, he wouldn't pull the trigger, wouldn't pull the trigger, wouldn't pull the trigger. And then with this, was like, okay, done deal. Let's go.
Yeah.
And then, so after that, I moved to Nashville. We did a bunch of management stuff. We started a label. Dumped all of my life savings into that, which was scary and a bad idea. But ultimately turned out to be a good idea because made it all back. And it's turned out to be a profitable endeavor, but at the time I had no idea. But I knew that we were doing all this work to, all of our artists were independent. So we're doing all this work. We're doing all the work that the labels were supposedly going to do.
Right.
And we were like, well, that's kind of fucked because number one, we don't own the master or the publishing.
Yeah.
And like, and you know, we, and we're making only 20%. So if we just start a label,
yeah.
We don't have to deal with any of their touring mishigosh, but like we can also develop a catalog.
Yeah.
So it just like made a lot of sense. You know, the other part was, you know, that, of course, while we were doing so much of that promotion for our management clients, you know, we weren't paying for the advertising and, you know, the content. So we had to do that. And, but, you know, started just diving into finding artists that I felt like would work for the kind of, you know, promotion style, you know, like system that we had developed. And found this kid, Ahmad Royal, on Hype Machine.
Yeah.
My first go-to was just like find people that I thought were going to do well on Hype Machine. Cause I knew like that was at least a space that we could pretty easily pop somebody off and that would translate into other spaces.
Right. It's like a good lane.
And Ahmad was making these remixes at the time and like had no original tunes. I sort of reached out to him. I was like, hey, are you making original music? And he's like, yeah, you know, I actually like want to sing too. I was like, even fucking better, dude.
Yeah.
He sent me cycles and I was just like, holy fuck, I need this. You know, kind of gave him some advice and just like over the period of, I think it took like 5 or 6 months of just like hitting him up, checking in. How's it going, man? How's the mixing going? How's like this process going? Any advice I can give you? You know, just like giving him like free
need?
Pointers. What do you need? Like, what can I offer? What can I help with?
Yeah.
You know, like, and you know, eventually he was just like, yeah, cool, let's do it. So we did it. That was the first release we had. It popped. It went off. Like Passenger went number one on Hype Machine, got all of these organic plays on Spotify. Spotify wasn't even really an important thing to us at that point.
Right.
What we wanted was Billboard charting on iTunes. We got all these pre-saves. We got all these pre-sales, you know, on iTunes. It would have charted on Billboard.
Right.
If not for the banking system breach that happened in that time.
Right.
It was so fucked. So the pre-save, I had developed the system to get people charting on Billboard, which was basically, now that system has changed, I can divulge my secret because it doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah.
But at the time when you bought a pre-sale, on iTunes for an EP or an album.
Yeah.
Well, your card wasn't charged.
Right.
It was just a button that you hit that basically was you saying, when this goes live, charge my card. Now it's different. Now, as soon as you hit it, charges your card. But the difference was that at that point, what that meant is if you got 300 of those, well, then guess what? You sold 300 albums in a single day.
Right.
Which means that you're going to be on the top 20 Billboard electronic charts.
Yeah.
And then the whole bank thing happened, which meant that everyone was issued a new debit card.
Right.
All of them went away.
That sucks.
I think we got like, we ended up getting like 25 of them like left.
Yeah.
And I was just gutted. I was gutted. I was like, no. It's like freaking out. But it worked out anyway. You know, like we got all these Spotify plays. You know, we got all this press. And, you know, like, had like an amazing team that, you know, worked on the PR side of it. You know, I sat down and like really worked with, you know, Ahmad to come up with like all of the ancillary content. You know, and like, you know, we're doing sorts of weird stuff, like trying like remarketing campaigns with music where we were like sending people to a website to get a download and then take, you know, tracking a cookie and then like shooting you back an ad. Like, and just kind of just doing weird stuff that, you know, we thought just trying shit out, just trying new things out and, you know, and it worked and we were like, cool, we're amazing. We're going to be great. We're going to be perfect. And of course, like it's similar to Cry Wolf, like very instant success. And then like the next like 4 or 5 things we tried just like did not work. And you know, then we had, this, some buddies of ours called Bronze Whale had this amazing EP that worked. We had this kid Kai, K-H-A-I, with the song Do You Go Up.
Uh-huh.
That fucking blew up. That worked. You know, and then things started to trickle in later, you know, which we like, you know, weren't really, that was such a learning experience of just like, you know, the life of the song is not just the week it comes out.
Yeah.
Like you can extend it. You can find people to work on the sync side of things. You can, you know, figure out how to get this into the hands of college radio kids. And like, you can, you know, keep pushing things and trying to do like brand partnerships and just again, more questions came in.
Yeah.
More ill-conceived answers came in. And then over time, those answers got better. And, you know, ended up getting some syncs with American Idol and Disney. And I think there was like a Star Wars related one in there as well, some commercial. Stores wanted to put Ahmad and Kai's music in their stores. As that turns out, you get shit royalties from that, but still,
people are hearing it.
Would get people on Twitter like, I heard it in Express, amazing, like so cool, you know? And it just like, it builds kind of the story more. So did that. After a year, ended up deciding to move on from that because, you know, we were making our money back, but it was just like, we had sort of realized that the amount of money that we put in that was like our life savings was just the tip of the iceberg of what we would need to like really do things right.
Right.
So much of the label was really predicated upon Dex and my sweat equity.
Right.
Like all of the money just went directly into advertising and PR.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we didn't, like all the content I was making, all of the accounting Dex was doing, like, you know, all of the adminning of everything we were collectively doing. And, you know, even on the PR front, like we would reach out, like it was never like, here, PR person, go and do your thing. Like we would be there to like, make sure that like everything was going and like touch, you know, working all sides of the thing.
Yeah.
And at the time we were also trying to like, run a blog. We were also trying to start a YouTube channel. We were trying to like do all these things that, you know, we felt would be like actively contributing to our brand. You know, and again, the situation of more questions pop up. Like, okay, well, as you do more things that you feel like you should be doing,
right?
Who are going to do all these things? You can't do all these things by yourself. Okay, so what do you do? So do you add more partners? Do you hire more people? Is this what you want to be doing? Do you want to run a company or do you want to be in the trenches, so to speak, doing that specific task?
Yeah.
You know, like, and you know, you start, as you answer some questions, other questions pop up and it's not necessarily where you thought you might end up. You start learning more about the industry, but you start learning more about yourself as well and what you want. You know, and so, you know, like, I think it's really important, especially when you have business partners, to realize when there's a point that you want different things. Because there, if you let that, you can marinate on that to a certain extent, but there is a very blurred line between marinating and festering.
Right.
And you just can't let it get to that point. So, you know, I think one of the best business decisions that's ever been a part of like my life or style of business decisions, and I feel like this is true for everybody, is the moment where you sort of realize where you're pivoting and going in a different direction.
Right.
And also the people in your life that affects and involves, you know, and figuring out a way for that to work for everybody, because there, 9 times out of 10, there is, you know, everyone's going to have to make compromises in that space, but there's really a way to work it out. You know, so I ended up moving from Nashville and leaving the Hero Bus project to kind of like solely focus on Cry Wolf and, you know, try and figure out what else I wanted to do.
Right.
And I lived in North Carolina for a bit to try and figure out where I wanted to go. Cause I was like, I want to move somewhere. I want to go to a bigger pond.
Right.
Initially we moved to Nashville, or I moved to Nashville because of like Hunter and Dex were there. But at the same time, this was kind of around the time where like the whole like Avicii Don't Wake Me Up stuff was happening. And we were like, holy shit. We live in country capital and we're the only EDM people here. That was the original concept for the label, was we were like, we're going to be the EDM guys. We're going to fucking produce all this shit for all these country stars. This is an international hit. It's the biggest song in the fucking world.
Yeah.
We're going to walk into Sony and like all these different places and like, they're going to shake our hands and welcome us and be like, yes, absolutely. Make EDM music with our country stars.
Yeah.
And we were just like, foolproof plan. Walked into all of these companies and they patted us on the head and said, that's nice, kid, on your way.
Yeah.
They didn't give a shit. Yeah. Couldn't give a fuck yeah. about what we were doing. Couldn't care less. And why should they? They have their system.
Of course.
They sell CDs.
Yeah.
They are on the radio. That's their system. It does not change.
Yeah.
You know, and if you want to change it, which we did, it's seen as a threat, rightfully so. Like, those guys have had a sustainable system for yeah. decades.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so, I mean, who knows how long? Like, I mean, they've really just figured it out, and it's a machine. There's a reason there's a label called Big Machine.
Right.
You know, yeah. like, it is a machine. And they do their thing, and they do it very well. So I was like, I need to go to a bigger city. You know, it's either going to be New York or Chicago or LA. New York was too expensive. Chicago was a vibe in select months, and then definitively not a vibe in all of the other months.
Yeah, you pretty much get like summer and a little bit of the fall.
Yeah, I love Chicago, and I love yeah. everyone from Chicago.
It's because great.
It's like the perfect mixture of the Midwestern politeness,
yep.
but they have culture.
Yeah.
Because it's a big city. So they're cool, but nice.
Yeah.
So it was like really came down to be between New York and LA, and LA just made the most sense. It was cheaper. It was warm all the time.
What year was this? When did you come out?
A year and a half ago.
Okay.
I was making this decision like 2 years ago.
Okay.
I sold as much stuff as I could possibly sell so that I could fit everything that I owned into a Honda Fit. And I drove myself across the country.
Yeah. There you go.
Which is a great experience that if you have not done, you should definitely do.
Makes you realize how massive the country is.
Number one, it makes you realize how massive this country is. That's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
But number two, it makes you realize just like how much you, when you grow up and you think about travel and like worldly exploration, you think about like going to like Central America or Europe, like, or all these places. And you just immediately realize you're like, I haven't seen shit. Like, I've seen like my hometown and like the suburb and like the shopping like
yeah.
centers.
Yeah.
I haven't seen shit. Like, there's so much in this country that like you can explore that's here. And I don't want to discourage people from worldly travel. You should absolutely do worldly travel. I have not done nearly as much as I'd like to at this point in my life.
Yeah.
Came out my Fit. And I had visited LA a few times before. So I had friends here. I had friends that I had never met through the internet that I had been talking to for like years. Like, and like we were friends. The only difference was we just had not met in person, which I love about this age. I love that that's a thing. Because anytime I've ever met an internet friend, no pun intended. But anytime I've ever met an internet friend in person, it's never weird. You always think it's like, you're like, is this going to be weird? It's never weird.
Right.
It's always, there's just always like, oh, this is feels extremely natural. We've done this before.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and so I just, it feels very special that we're one of the first generations who's able to do that. You know, there's like pen pals and shit, like, but it's like not the same.
Yeah. And like people were doing that on like Usenet.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, like, so I love that about our generation. I think there's a special connectivity.
Yeah.
And I think it's made us more empathetic as a generation because we're so connected to each
yeah.
other. And so, yeah. So I immediately, like, parked the car, went to Owsla Halloween party. And was just like, I have made the right choice. I'm here. Like, this is a good idea. All of these people that I've been talking to, I meet like every 2 seconds, I mean, oh my God, we have not met. Like, you know, like, and yeah, just like started over again. Like, you know, doing all the things that I was doing, but just like on with all the information that I had learned and figured out, you know, picked up another artist called Savoy, started working with them and, you know, kind of started specializing and branching out into other stuff, doing social media consulting for people, things that I was very special, like had as my specialty that I was doing for my artists. You know, I started figuring out that you can, you know, you don't necessarily have to do that specifically for your artists. It's great that you can bring those skills to that table, but you can do that for other people. You can do it for brands. You can do it for bigger artists. You can do it for other management companies. You know, you can do marketing consulting. You can do social media consulting. You can do marketing management, social media management. You can do rights management. I mean, there's all this other stuff that you can do and figure out, like, about and to use the skills that you have in different ways. And, you know, we were talking about this before, like, we turned the microphones on, but, like, you know, I love management, and this is, the following is not at all a jab to management, because I very clearly love it. Otherwise, I would have stopped doing it a really long time ago. Because ultimately, the financial value of doing management is not worth it. You do it because you love it. You do it because you care.
Yeah. Like, it's one of those things that doesn't pay off for a very, very long time. And
no,
it may never fully pay off.
If you want to get into the music industry for money, then you should be an accountant or lawyer, you know, or go through the label system. Like, and even then it's dodgy. Definitely don't be a manager. You do it because you love it. But also, if there's any training wheels to the music industry, it's being a manager in EDM, because there's zero barrier to entry and the artists have very little overhead and there's just one of them. So finding them and accessing them, like, if you want to start managing a band, there's a lot of things that you really need to know before jumping into that.
Yeah, you gotta know a lot of stuff.
If you want to manage a DJ producer, well, then really all you need to know is how to, like, make the internet work in your favor.
Yeah. And then maybe, like, how to set up CDJs.
Yeah. You know, and you can figure out the rest pretty easily.
Yeah.
So you just, it's a really good, and in a lot of ways, pretty inconsequential way to kind of fail your way up.
Right.
And learn more about you and learn about the skills that you naturally gravitate to and the things that you like to do, you know, and just as important, what you don't want to do. You start figuring out, you know, where you want to go with it, what you want to do. Do you want to go to a management company? Can you even go to a management company? You know, do you want to stay independent? I think there's a lot of managers who've made it, so to speak, and gotten really big and went to work for bigger management companies and will tell you, I wish I had never done this.
Right.
On the other side of things, there's a lot of people who now work for management companies that were independent will tell you this is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me.
Yeah.
But I think what's really important to learn about the entertainment industry is that there is rules in the sense that the US government has set laws based on royalties. And from those laws, companies have formulated because there's legal parameters.
Right.
And then by the way that those companies formed, then other things formed around those things. So there are parameters created. But other than those very specific parameters, there's no rules.
Yeah.
It's the wild, wild west out here.
Yeah.
Like, do whatever it is that makes you feel like when you get up in the morning, you're super fucking pumped about. Because if you're not super pumped about it, there's zero purpose in doing this.
Right.
Because as I illuminated before, it's really, you're really not, you can get very successful and make a lot of money. But also, there's just no even guarantee in that space. 50 Cent's manager with that vitamin water deal, I mean, that was a $50 million deal. It's one of the biggest, you know, like, that at the time, that was one of the biggest deals to ever happen.
Yeah.
And then I think, like, he lost it all.
Right.
You know, it's just like, it's, you can get to the top and just, like, immediately fall, you know, like, and there's a whole ton of reasons why stuff like that happens. Like, that's not just like, you know, nothing's in a vacuum. But I think the point really is that, like, you know, if you're going to do it for the money, then just, like, go be in real estate or, like, you know, an accountant or, like, honestly, if you want something stable, you should work, like, you should work at, like, a funeral home or as an accountant, because there's two things that are going to continually happen, and that's death and taxes.
Definitely.
And those are the only guaranteed things in life.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, nothing's really stable, and entertainment is definitely not stable.
No.
So if the reason you're doing it is because you love it, then you should do that to the nth degree. Do what you love. If what you love is what you love is managing artists and manage artists. But, you know, you might only like to manage a certain kind of artist. You might only like to work with a certain kind of label. You might only want to work with a certain kind of music, you know. And even in those spaces, there might be personalities that don't fit well with you.
Yeah.
And those are just things that you learn from experience. You can't know the answers to those questions just by asking them.
Right.
You really have to like just try
get your hands dirty.
And get your hands dirty and learn things about yourself. If you're a younger person listening to this and your hope, and you, first of all, if you've made it this far, then thank you. You're a saint. I can't believe you listened to my fucking ramblings for this long. But secondly, you know, if I had any, not necessarily advice, but words of encouragement, it's that, first of all, do it. Yeah. Definitely do it, because if you are what I just described, that means you're young and it means you're hungry and it means you're passionate. And you need to realize what a gold mine it is to be able to say those three things about yourself. Don't be so hard on yourself. Just do things. It will always work out. Like there's always something, you know, and I think the number one question people always ask is like, well, people will ask, how did you get into this?
Right.
And you asked it in the right way, because what you really meant was, tell me the story about how you got into this.
Yeah.
But when kids who are looking for advice ask that, that's not what they meant. They don't want, tell me your story. What they want is, please tell me how you paid the rent while you weren't making money.
Yeah.
That's what they want to ask.
Yeah.
And they never actually ask that. They say, how did you get into this? But that's what they mean. And the answer to that is, use the other skills that you have.
Right.
I was a graphic designer. So when Crywolf wasn't making money, I was making commercials for, you know, local businesses. I was making logos for, you know, local brands. I was doing web design for people. I was making websites. I was doing anything I possibly could to pay the rent. And in my spare time, you know, balancing and trying to build this career.
Yeah.
You're going to have to put in a lot of sweat equity to make it work. You know, and if you're fortunate enough to have the funding either from your parents or somewhere else, then great. Use that. Use that advantage. Use every advantage you possibly have to get you to where you need to go and do the things that you need to do. Because that's, you know, that's really... Everyone else is doing the same thing.
Right. Like there's no reason why you should like fight with a hand tied behind your back just because you feel like you got to do it.
Yeah. And I think there's always going to be some semblance of that. I think like, you know, there's people in this industry who in any given industry, especially based in a capitalistic system,
yeah,
there's going to be fucking psychopaths,
yeah,
who don't have any emotion towards anybody and they don't give a shit. They don't fucking care. Like, and they don't care who they hurt. They don't care what happens along the way. They're just going to do them. And that makes for a lot of successful people.
Yeah.
If you can get over caring about others, being successful in business becomes a lot easier. And that's a hard truth about capitalism. I think the moral to the story is really not drop your morals, but, you know, like realize what you're doing with them and realize, you know, realize why you're doing the things you're doing, or realize why you're not doing the things you're doing. You know, realize whatever you're doing, you need to first manage yourself.
Right.
There's this really great Jimmy Iovine quote. I love Jimmy and I love what he does. He's a legend. But there's this great quote where he's talking about working in the studio with, I think it was Bruce Springsteen. Mm-hmm. He was like, you're there to help that artist achieve their dream. Nothing else. And that is 99.9999999% true. And I'm going to catch a lot of flack for even remotely suggesting that Jimmy Iovine's wrong. But the thing is, he's not wrong, but there is an additive to that.
Right.
You're there to help because it also benefits your dreams.
Yeah.
You achieve your dreams through helping. And now if you let your ego get the best of it, then you're not going to achieve what you originally set out for. But Jimmy was in that room because he wanted to be a record man.
Right. He wanted to be a dream facilitator.
He wasn't in that room because he wanted to, you know, be a slave to Bruce Springsteen's career. He did that because he realized if he set his ego aside and helped Bruce, that he'd then achieve his dream. But he was there in the first place because he wanted to achieve his dream. And you cannot lose sight of that ever. Because everyone you're working with, the artists, they're never losing sight of that.
Right.
The labels, they're never losing sight of that. The agents are never losing sight of that. So I think it's just important to remember the really delicate balance between, you know, yourself and then the people around you that you're working for. And if you can do the Jimmy thing and figure out how to balance that with getting your ego out of the way, then you're going to fucking soar.
It's great.
You know, like, yeah. And I like the Jimmy quote because it feels really nice.
It does.
It feels great.
Yeah.
You're just there, you know, get your ego out. You're there to support. It's so true.
Yeah.
But you know, like it's tough. It's tougher, especially when you're on the service side of things, to say, hey, constantly remember yourself, because it sounds selfish. But the thing is, it's true.
When you're working with people and you can line up your dreams together, it's like, hey, I want to be a mega manager and you want to be a super artist.
Yeah.
Let's work together and we're going to make that happen for each other in a way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, so that's such a perfect transition.
Yeah.
Because where what I was saying sounds selfish, it's actually not.
Yeah.
Because it's only going to work when you find those situations.
Yeah.
Unless you and the people you're working with, your dreams line up, it's not going to fucking work.
No.
So that's what I was saying about, like, you know, when I left Nashville, you know, and Dex and I figured out a scenario in which we could both achieve our dreams and go separate ways and make things work. Like, is that, you want to, sometimes when you start in a certain space, if you're at, you know, if you want to get from A to Z, it's never A to B. There's always a million steps in between. And so if you want to get to an A to Z, then, you know, when you're at A, then your dreams are aligned.
Right.
You know, and you could get all the way to M, dreams are still aligned. You know, and then you get a little bit farther down the line, maybe the dreams are not as aligned. You know, I think it's about sometimes those dreams are aligned at the jump, then it kind of diverges. And the thing is, you can't be afraid of that. You have to, if the dreams are aligned and it feels right, and it's a gut thing. Like I saw this, she's a DJ and a producer and she does a bunch of different stuff, but I really admire like the way that she's building out her brand. Her name's Cray. I think she's going about it in a really interesting and modern way. She tweeted something today about like, this kind of piece of advice for artists that are not as far along as she is, which was that, you know, take the time to figure out your team. It will be worth it, which is true to some extent, or to a large extent. But the truer thing that she said was, when you meet with people, if it feels off, stay true to that. If it feels off, you're right about that.
Right.
Even if you're not right about that, you're right about it.
Right.
Even if you're wrong and you're the one who's the problem in the situation, doesn't matter.
Uh-huh.
It's going to fail either way.
Yeah.
So when you meet people, and even if they're your buds, even if they're your friends, it could be your best friend could say, let's do business together. And you want to because it's your best bud. If it feels wrong, don't do it.
Right.
If it feels right, do it. And it's really hard to get to that binary space of like, you know, what shouldn't I do? But it really becomes pretty simple because ultimately you don't know what's going to work and what's going to fail. Nobody does.
Yeah.
Everyone really likes to pretend that they do, but you really don't. You can know what might be successful or might not be successful, but at the end of the day, you just don't know. And you got to just do shit that feels right to you. But also, taking care of yourself. I think there was a lot of times that, you know, I certainly have in my career, other people, I think everyone has in their career, where they made compromises about what, you know, they were going to do in order to get to the next step. They just so badly wanted to get to the next step. Something felt right. And they were like, you know, the relationship felt right. And then they wanted to do something, you know? And so they're like, oh, I just want to get to that next step. I want to, you know, be like working together and doing all these things, like making things happen.
Yeah.
You know, and they kind of skip some steps of like setting it up correctly.
Yeah.
And that's a poor choice. You don't want to do that because again, you're in your gut going to know that's wrong. That doesn't feel right. So I think the ultimate leverage is really everyone feeling good about what they're doing.
Right.
Because there's really like, you can paper things, you know, and the most secure things, I guess, are really the publishing side of things with like co-pub stuff where they just sign everything over and it's just like definitively, this is a work for hire. We fucking own it. That's that.
Right.
Like, you know, but ultimately, even in those spaces, you could have things papered to a T. If an artist wants to do something, they're going to do something, you know, like, and there's not a whole lot that you can do.
Yeah.
You know,
like you can't make anybody do anything.
You can't make anybody do anything.
Yeah.
Exactly. So the only thing you can do is figure out a scenario in which if that happens, here's what we agree to happen.
Right.
And even then, they might not do that thing.
Yeah.
You know, so there's other styles of like leverage in the industry, but I think it's the main thing about leverage, I think, is that it's important to realize what you have and what you don't have. And so I think on the artist side of things, it's really important because like a lot of artists will be like, you know, why don't I have this thing? Why am I not on this blog? And why am I not getting booked for this festival? And blah, 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 and like, you know, and it's like, okay, well, you know, that could be some of the things that you might immediately go to, which is that, you know, maybe your manager isn't powerful enough. Maybe your agent isn't powerful enough. But perhaps it's just that the talent buyer simply didn't want you on their festival.
Yeah.
You know, perhaps like, you know, you need to be a bit bigger. And you know, the more cognizant you are, the more opportunities you can go after that are within the space that you know,
right,
are probably going to work
like
out.
Like those small attainable reaches.
Sure. I mean, I think like taking quantum leaps and making things happen is important. You gotta
definitely
do it.
Yeah.
Like I have made a practice every like at least I used to do it every single day. And then that got like silly.
Yeah.
But I still to this day, every week, once a week, I send a cold call email to someone huge who I am convinced is not going to fucking email me back.
Yeah.
But that's over the course of a year. That's over 50 emails
yeah.
that you've sent. The chances of you getting one of those back, it's reasonable.
Yeah.
It's not high, but it's reasonable.
Yeah.
You know, so, and then the chances of you compound that over years, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, don't stick to it. Like maybe you do it twice a week or like whatever. Like who fucking knows?
It's not
once a
big
month.
Deal.
Doesn't
yeah.
matter. Like you might get one of those back. So I think shooting your shot, there's the Wayne Gretzky thing.
Yeah.
Right? Like you're gonna miss all the shots you don't take.
Of course.
So you absolutely should shoot your shot.
Yeah.
But you know, if you're going to utilize your prowess or the things that you've built as a reason, besides just like, I think I'm dope and I think like you might want to work with this.
Yeah.
You know, you just need to be cognizant of what would you do in that position if you were some big label A&R.
Right.
And this artist with the amount of followers that you have or the amount of plays that you have, which honestly, in the grand scheme of things, not fucking important at all.
Right.
The things that are most important are whether or not they really fuck with your music and they really fuck with your brand.
Yeah.
Those are the things that get moved because like you could have 500,000 plays, but that's not doing it for a major. They're concerned in the hundreds of millions of plays. That's what's really going to make their money back. So, you know, I think artists can get really caught up in like, and I think managers can get caught up and agents can get caught up in like, you know, did I get this blog feature? That's important. You know, you want those little steps, those little pebbles you know, there's a healthy amount of kind of realizing the bigger picture, like, you know, and realizing what steps it takes you to get to that bigger picture.
Yeah.
And not getting really caught up in like, how do I make a single step? Make the step, shoot your shot, move on to the next step. If you're getting stuck, maybe you skipped a step. You know, maybe you didn't do it as well as you thought you did.
Right.
At a certain point, you just gotta go and do. And I think focus on you. And then the people who want to work with you, and then the people who you don't have to utilize your quote unquote leverage to convince, those are ultimately the people you really want involved.
Yeah.
Like the people who are the situations in which you're like, I have X and I have X, you're always gonna have to sell yourself.
Definitely.
Like there's that rule of like, you know, always be pitching, right? You know, but at the same time, you know, so many of the wins and successes I've had in my career really just came from like other people reaching out and being like, hey, we saw this thing that was really dope.
And just buying into it without even having.
Right. So, you know,
letting it sell itself.
At least I think everyone's got their own strategy and what they've done, but at least so much of my career has been spent on focusing 80 to 90% of your effort on making your product as dope as it possibly can fucking be. Because all of the other things will just fall into place if you do that.
Yeah.
Especially if you're an artist. You know, like artists get really caught up in, especially younger artists, about, you know, like, who am I talking to? Who's following me on Twitter? I gotta be in part of the conversation. And you do. You know, it's not unimportant.
Yeah.
But if you focus more of your energy on making dope shit, those people will come out of the woodwork.
Yeah. And those types of things I feel like are more symptoms of success, not symptoms in like a bad way, but those are sort of more like how many playlists you're getting on and how many, you know, people are talking about you and how many blogs are talking about you are more a result of how good you're doing in the studio and how good your music is rather than sort of like something that is a goal to go after and a goal to attain. Like when you're focusing on that 90%, then people will start talking about you and then you will start getting picked up.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, and pretty much anyone who's especially artists who are super successful, they'll tell you the same thing.
Yeah.
Any artist who gives advice to other artists, which is the advice I think is honestly some of the most valuable advice. Artists from managers is definitely not as valuable.
Yeah.
As advice from managers is definitely not as valuable as advice from artists who've made it.
Right.
You know, and especially artists who've made it over a lengthy period of time. That's the best advice because they'll all say the same thing, which is focus on you, focus on your art, make it as best as you possibly can, and everything else will fall into place.
Right.
Set up a team that you feel comfortable with and you like working with and you know will protect you and have your back. Like, and everything else will fall into place. You know, it's important to have reaches. It's important to have relationships. Those things will come. Like you see some of the people who are being touted as like the new guard of management, like people like Pat, the manager.
Yeah.
Chance was his first client, you know, like had nothing. Like his blueprint was just totally like, you're a good guy. You and Chance have a vibe. You and Chance work well together and your dreams are aligned. So go and learn together and figure it out. And they did, you know, and now they're on top of the world.
Yeah.
You know, and he signed other people. He's making that happen. Like, you know, now that he knows all these things, now he knows the steps, he knows the pathway, he can put other people into place. You see, like, you know, the artist that he's working with, like Claro, like her video doesn't even have the, and she might've changed it at this point, but her video title is just like my new song, LOL. It's not even the title of her song. And it's like one of the biggest videos. It's not even, there's no crazy production on it. It's her MacBook camera and microphone. And she's sitting on her bed singing into it. Like, and it blew up because all she was doing was just focusing on her and her art and not caring about anything else. Like, you know, and there's always exceptions to the rule. There's always some artist someone can point to about like, well, you know, they're actually not, and they're really just like plugged in and this, that, and whatever. And it's like, if you get caught up, you can always get caught up in like example city, like, but it's just like causation doesn't equal correlation.
Right.
So I think it's, you know, leverage is important and you should be cognizant about how much you have of it in any given situation, because one of the absolute worst things you can fucking do in this industry is overstep your bounds when you don't have the leverage to back it up.
Right.
That's really the only time anyone's going to get pretty pissed off at you.
Like in a situation where you might cost somebody money or something like that. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. You know, like you take too much money from a label that you definitely can't make back, or, money's a very good example of it. You know, if you take too much money from a talent buyer and you don't make it back for them, like, you know, you, then that talent buyer is probably not going to bring you back. And that talent buyer probably put you on in the first place because the artist that was larger in the roster, like, got leveraged in order to put you on. Or that artist, you know, passed up on this opportunity and it got filtered down to you. And you're just being paid more than you're worth and you don't back it up. You know, you don't properly reinvest in your art or your own marketing and you don't back it up. You know, that's an example of a space in which you're touting leverage that you don't have.
Right.
And it can work. You can definitely fake it till you make it.
Right.
There's cases of that, and I think a fair amount of them. But, you know, it will eventually bite you in the ass. Yeah, leverage is a funny thing, but it's also fickle. And there's just zero substitute for just... your art is good as fuck.
Do you have any closing thoughts?
My closing thoughts are that your opening thoughts should always be that you love art. You know, I said it a few times, but you do this because you love it. You love art. You want to help artists. You want to make a difference in a community. And you want to be successful. You want to make money.
Yeah.
You know, you want the recognition for what you're doing. And those are all important parts of it. And you shouldn't lose sight of those things, but they're definitely secondary. You do it because you love it. Focus on yourself. Have people around you that you trust. Trust yourself. You trust what your gut says. You know, be okay with the fact that you are going to fail at some point.
Right.
And, you know, just learn, make sure you learn from those spaces and that, you know, I think it's okay to have your pity parties, have them, you know, because those things are going to happen and they're going to suck. But as long as you learn from them, they're fine because they're going to happen. Yeah, you know, it was really awesome to have had the opportunity to be a part of the industry talks, you know, when it was first starting. And I've learned a lot since I did that.
Yeah.
And it's grown so much since then. I actually, like, I'd be remiss if I didn't take the opportunity to congratulate, like, you guys on how cool and extensive this brand has gotten.
Thank you, man.
It's really taken off and gotten, like... really cool, and there's been so many cool people on it, and so many such cool pieces of advice and insights, you know, and things that I've learned.
Thank you.
Along the way.
Yeah.
So keep up the good work.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks so much, man.
And that's that.
Great.
So that's our show. Make sure you check out Ian Galdi online at Galditron. And again, we have a pretty big change coming to the panel in LA in August. So if you want to keep up with that news, follow us online at IND Talks on Twitter and also industrytalks.net. Thanks for listening.